Hi, everybody. Marco Werman here. Before we get into the show, I've got some exciting news to share. The world is participating in Newsmatch. From now until the end of the year, every dollar donated to the world will be matched. This means that a gift of $50 will actually provide $100 of support to our work here at The World. If you have ever considered giving to The World, today is the day to take intention and turn it into action, one that we will be deeply grateful for. Every day, The World crosses borders and time zones to bring you stories that matter. As a nonprofit newsroom, we rely on contributions from listeners like you to keep our reporting free and accessible to all. With Newsmatch, you can double your impact. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, and we cannot do it without you. Head to theworld.org/give to donate today. From everybody here at The World, thank you. All eyes on the U.S. election. Today on The World, the view from Israel and Russia.
In case of Biden, he might tighten the screws and might take a harder line.
We also hear the view from someone who assesses risks that can send countries into chaos. Now he's watching President Trump.
He actually stokes tension in order to try and achieve personal and political goals.
Also today, you think you follow U.S. politics? A Cuban asylum seeker in Mexico is so dialed in that he knows the number of California's electoral votes.
55 la California, no?
55. What America's election means to would-be Americans. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. It's just after 4 p.m. here in the East and still no official winner for the American presidency. Joe Biden appears close to reaching that all-important number, 270 electoral votes, but the nation needs to wait a bit longer. Here's what we do know. A trend that really took off 2 years ago has continued. Immigrants, first and second generation Americans running for office. The World's Roopa Shenoy takes a look at how those candidates fared.
Here's a partial list of the winners. Samba Balde, an immigrant from The Gambia, will represent a mostly white area in the Wisconsin state legislature as its first Muslim member. Nikita Ricks, a refugee from Liberia, is joining the Colorado House. Keisha Ram, the daughter of an Indian immigrant father and Jewish American mother, is now the first woman of color in the Vermont Senate. And this is Iman Judah, the daughter of Palestinian immigrants and refugees, who's become Colorado's first Muslim lawmaker.
I'm very proud that Colorado has decided to break that glass ceiling, make history, but also I have a strong track record of advocating for all communities.
Judah and all the candidates I mentioned ran as Democrats. Immigrants and their allies were also behind the historic political shift in Arizona. Democrat and Mexican-American paramedic Melody Hernandez won a seat in the Arizona House. There she'll join another daughter of immigrants, Arizona House Minority Whip Athena Salmon.
It's exciting to be at that turning point.
Salmon was also reelected this week and says the state's seismic political shift didn't just happen naturally. She says it took 10 years of organizing by an alliance of marginalized communities that came together to fight what they saw as Republican leaders' anti-immigrant policies.
That was the catalyst where so many organizations and unions here on the ground made a commitment and made a promise to Arizonans that we would fight back and build an Arizona where everyone has the opportunity to succeed and leave behind an Arizona that for too long has been defined by racism and that scapegoating.
Many of the immigrants and children of immigrants who ran for office this year had the same stated goals: to defend democracy, diversity, and inclusiveness. In Georgia, Chinese-American anesthesiologist Michelle Au was treating COVID patients, listening to the president call it the China virus, and campaigning for a seat in the state Senate, which she won this week.
It is incredibly exciting to be in Georgia in this moment because you really feel that you are living through this inflection point in American politics.
Au says when she moved to Georgia 10 years ago, it was a dependable state for Republicans, and she never expected that to change so fast.
It's rare, I think, that anything in politics happens that quickly. It feels like it's in time lapse. Trump got elected, and I think it spurred a lot of people like myself to really step up and be part of that change in a more active way.
These first and second generation Americans will play an important role in helping people in the U.S. visualize themselves as part of a more integrated country, says Sayu Bajwani, founder of New American Leaders, the group that trains candidates.
They're redefining and helping us reimagine what an American leader looks like. They are reflecting the full breadth of the American experience, which includes the immigrant and refugee experience. And that's both a sign of progress, but also an indication of how far we have to go so that these folks are not the first and the only.
With that, Bajwani acknowledges that these new office holders will likely be entering tough environments where they will be one of few non-whites and may face racism. She says they'll have to be realistic about what they can accomplish.
Sometimes the best that they can do is push back against negative legislation and help educate their fellow colleagues about the actual implications of that legislation.
Still, long-term, Abdullahi Abdullah hopes people like him in local offices will have an overall national impact. Abdullah is a Somali immigrant, city planner, and military veteran who just won a seat on the city council in the Minneapolis suburb of New Brighton.
I'm hopeful that these small wins will extrapolate, and in the future, somebody like Trump will not be able to have followers that will listen to his fear-mongering because they then know that, oh, I know Abdullahi. He's somebody that's serving in our local city council. So I'm hoping it will have like even bigger implications in the future.
Abdullahi and other first and second generation office holders who won this week seem to be saying that while the U.S. may be divided now, local communities are putting the pieces in place to change things in the future. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Votes are still being counted. You and I are watching and waiting. So are leaders all over the world. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is one of those leaders who's had an especially cozy relationship with the incumbent. So how are Israelis seeing what's playing out politically here in the U.S.? The World's Ariel Osaran joins me from Tel Aviv. How are Israelis reacting to what's going on here, Ariel? Does Bibi Netanyahu's relationship with Trump tell the whole story?
Well, Marco, not quite at the moment. As of yet, no leader has made any public comment about the elections, but everyone here is really on pins and needles. What's making headlines here is Trump's reaction to the results and his intent to challenge them in battleground states. Some media outlets in Israel called the president's self-proclaimed victory speech on Tuesday night Trump's speech of lies, and that his actions since are sowing chaos in an already divided America. But in fact, for most Israelis, Trump is by far seen as the preferred candidate. 63% of Israelis said that they'd vote for Trump if they could. That's the same level of support Trump got in Alabama on Tuesday.
Why is there so much support for Trump in Israel?
Because Trump is considered a very favorable American president towards Israel. He's done very favorable moves, such as recognizing Israel's sovereignty in the Golan Heights, moving the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Those are considered big moves that no administration until now has done and are seen as widely accepted and were applauded here in Israel.
Big moves, but controversial in many parts. President Trump, as I said, considered Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a very close friend. So what will it mean for Netanyahu if Biden ends up winning the race?
Yeah, you're definitely right, Marco. If the final vote ends in Biden's favor, Netanyahu loses a major asset of a close friend in the White House. In many occasions, Trump actually went out of his way and, like I said, against longstanding U.S. policy to help Netanyahu with domestic issues. You know, for decades, support for Israel was considered a bipartisan issue, but not so much under the Trump presidency. I spoke about this with Tal Schneider. She's the diplomatic correspondent for Israel's Globes newspaper. She says the current approach to Israel is not as bipartisan as it used to be, also from an Israeli perspective.
It's been heavily eroded since Netanyahu chose one side approach that he plays with the Republican Party, and he not only ignores the Democrat Party, he was actually bashing them. He was campaigning in Israel through 2019 three times, saying he was the one who fought Obama.
What were relations like between Obama and Netanyahu? And does that give us any clues as to the future relations between Netanyahu and Vice President Biden?
So first of all, it is important to remember that Obama was at times very supportive of Israel, whether it was legislation ensuring Israel's qualitative military edge in the region, or the $38 billion arms deal with Israel that was passed just before he left office. But personally, Obama and Netanyahu never really managed to get along. They didn't see eye to eye on negotiating with the Palestinians and the two-state solution. But the main source of contention between the two, if you recall, was around the nuclear talks with Iran.
Mm.
In 2015, just months before the JCPOA was signed, Netanyahu went behind Obama's back and spoke in Congress against the deal. So if Biden resumes nuclear talks with the Iranians, as he reportedly intends to do, that could stir up some old baggage. But Tal Schneider from Globe's newspaper isn't too worried about that.
They're going to get along just perfect. You know, I'm not worried about this a bit. Netanyahu will come out and say, we've been so good friends with Biden, and he will take from his archives one of those warm photos when they are sitting together around the table or so.
But you know, Marco, more generally, many Israelis saw Trump's 4 years in office as good for Israel and for Netanyahu. With the way the count currently looks, we might get to see whether Biden will also be both.
The World's Ariel Osaran with a perspective from Israel on the U.S. election. Thanks very much, Ariel.
Thanks, Marco.
For decades, the United States has taken the lead on global efforts to contain disease outbreaks from polio to influenza. But during this pandemic, the U.S. has become a nation divided on science and public health. This worries David Heyman. He's an infectious disease specialist, formerly with the World Health Organization. He's now a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Dr. Heyman, the World Health Assembly, the decision-making body, the WHO, they meet next week, and on the agenda, beating the pandemic through solidarity and science and preparing for the next pandemic. How do the consequences of the divisions we're now seeing in the U.S., how do they impact these goals of the Assembly?
Well, in the past, the U.S. has always played a very important role in mobilizing its own resources, but then in helping others around the world to respond to disease outbreaks and to pandemics such as the current one. My career was with the CDC in Atlanta, but during that career, I was detailed many times to WHO, including back in 1976, when there was a first outbreak of Ebola hemorrhagic fever. Along with a team of five other people from CDC, I went out to DRC, then the Zaire, and we were able to investigate that investigation with teams from other countries, which permitted the U.S. to begin a whole research program on Ebola. So that's just one example how important the World Health Organization linkage with the U.S. government is.
Some global labs for tracking diseases, I understand, are based in the U.S. To what extent does the U.S. situation complicate efforts to just track disease right now?
Well, WHO has what it calls collaborating centers, which are laboratories of expertise around the world. At CDC alone, there are 18 to 20 individual laboratories that serve as points of reference for the world in dealing with diseases such as polio, meningitis, and many, many other diseases. So if that collaboration with WHO is cut off, the world loses its ability to use these laboratories unless they establish bilateral relationships with the U.S.
Right. So in this moment, as the pandemic rages around the globe, how is the shifting role of the U.S., now a less active one, how is that already impacting efforts to coordinate and contain outbreaks?
Well, I can give you a good example that happened to me personally a few months ago. I'm actually teaching here in London at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and I mentor a woman who's in the government in Mongolia.
Mm.
And during one of our mentorship calls, she said to me, she said, I really don't know who we can turn to now for help with this pandemic coming along because of the failures that are occurring in Europe and in North America. Who do I turn to? And I had to say, you have to turn to countries in Asia and other countries, because my own agency, the CDC, is not only threatened now of having to withdraw its activities from WHO, but has actually been marginalized by the current response to the outbreak. And by so doing, the U.S. has lost its expertise in coordinating the response in the U.S.
So if Joe Biden wins, what does that mean for these global efforts?
Hopefully that will mean that CDC is restored to its proper place within the U.S. public health system, and also that the U.S. again becomes a major player in global health.
If Trump wins, what does that mean?
Well, I think that we've seen that there's been quite a decrease in the attention that's been paid to science. Hopefully he would see the importance of listening to the scientific community in the U.S., which is among the greatest in the world.
David Heyman is a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and a former leader at the CDC and the WHO. Dr. Heyman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the show, what does this presidential election look like from Russia's point of view? You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Earlier in the show, we heard reaction to the U.S. election from Israel. Let's find out now how it's being seen in Russia, where the results could have big consequences. The World's Daniel Offman is with me. Daniel, what's been the response in Russia to the U.S. election?
Well, of course, there hasn't been one single unified response in Russia. There's always a range of voices. But if we talk about the Kremlin, the state media, and how they see their election, there's actually been a lot of attention. I spoke with Pavel Koshkin. He studies U.S.-Russia relations at the Russian Academy of Sciences. Here's what he told me.
I believe Russian media are crazy about U.S. elections. Maybe Russian politicians pay attention to the election, but common people, they don't care.
In general, regular people aren't paying too much attention, but the state media is, and they're fueling tension. They're calling the election a comedy, a drama, and in some cases, they're saying there's chaos in the U.S. We've heard that idea from a variety of Russian politicians, but we haven't heard anything yet directly from Russian President Vladimir Putin.
And what about the response, Daniel, from non-government media and opposition politicians in Russia? How are they seeing the U.S. election?
Well, there's actually been some solid ongoing coverage in Russian independent media, and the approach has been similar to what we see in the U.S. People want to know the results. They want to know what it could mean for Russia. Opposition politicians in Russia are kind of using this moment as a way to educate Russians about how the U.S. election works. Opposition politician Vladimir Milov has been posting on Instagram, kind of explaining to his audience how the Electoral College works. And opposition leader Alexei Navalny tweeted earlier yesterday, quote, "Woke up and went on Twitter to see who won. Still unclear. Now that's what I call an election."
So what are some of the key issues the next U.S. president will be facing when it comes to U.S.-Russia relations?
Well, there are a bunch of unresolved conflicts and crises in countries bordering Russia where Russia has a lot of influence. There's the ongoing conflict in eastern Ukraine, which started with Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. There's the situation in Belarus, where Alexander Lukashenko, the Belarusian president of 26 years, refuses to leave office despite mass protests against him. And of course, there's an ongoing armed conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the Gorno-Karabakh and the Caucasus. These are all major issues where traditionally the U.S. would take some leadership and try to resolve some of these conflicts. Under Trump, that hasn't been the case, but that may change in the next 4 years.
I mean, the days of announcing a reset between the U.S. and Russia seem really dated, but are there areas that are more fertile than others where the U.S. and Russia can improve their working relationship?
Yeah, there actually are some key areas where the U.S. and Russia are somewhat on the same page. In terms of security in the Middle East, the U.S. and Russia are trying to weed out terrorist organizations such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and others. But perhaps one of the most pressing issues is arms control. Both the U.S. and Russia want to avoid getting into a new arms race. And there's a key treaty, the New START Treaty, which is going to expire in February next year, and that's coming up. So both sides would like to come to some sort of consensus on that.
So, Daniel, with all of these things in mind, if Biden is confirmed as the next president, how might he change the dynamic between the U.S. and Russia?
From the Kremlin's perspective, they say that the election results won't change much. They say that U.S. sanctions against Russia have only increased with Trump, so they believe that that trend will kind of continue with Biden or with Trump. Here's Pavel Koshkin again. He studies U.S.-Russia relations at the Russian Academy of Sciences.
In case of Biden, he might tighten the screws and might take a harder line. But in general, the current state of U.S.-Russia relations is bad, and they're not going to change in the near future.
Along those lines, I think the Kremlin understands that if Biden becomes president, he will be harder on Russia. But I think the biggest difference, though, is that with a Biden presidency, there actually will be a coherent U.S. policy towards Russia.
The World's Daniel Offman on what's at stake for the U.S. and Russia after this election. Daniel, thanks for keeping your eyes on this.
Thanks, Marco.
In Detroit, a scene from A Democracy Under Pressure. Republican poll watchers demanding yesterday to be allowed inside a convention center where ballots were being counted. Police blocked their entry. Election officials said the maximum number of poll watchers from both parties had already been reached. The crisis group has been analyzing conflicts across the globe, from Lebanon to Ethiopia to Myanmar, and now the United States. Stephen Pomper is the lead author of the crisis group report called The U.S. Presidential Election, Managing the Risks of Violence. He joins us now from Washington. When you see scenes like the one we just heard in Detroit yesterday, Republicans echoing Trump with stop the vote, what is your reaction?
One of the things that we were trying to do with our report was to give a little bit of an early warning that because of the mixture of risk factors that we were looking at this context, you could be seeing situations like that, and that states and localities, which really have responsibility for managing the electoral process here in the United States, needed to be prepared for it. And it sounded, from what you just described, like that was the case. In fact, you know, the local law enforcement authorities were ready for this and managed to create a cordon around the counting facility that allowed people to continue to do their work there.
Your report does talk about risk factors, political divisions, disinformation, armed militias, and something you call the Trump factor. Did the run-up to the U.S. election set off some kind of alarm bell at Crisis Group headquarters?
It really did, not just in the run-up to the election, but actually a little earlier than that, in the context of the Memorial Day police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. And what really sort of brought our attention to the U.S. in that context was not just the sort of combustible nature of that polarized dynamic here in the U.S., which was overlaid with issues of race and identity, but also the way in which the president and his leadership team were engaging with the issue and the very martial language that people were using to talk about how to manage the situation. You'll remember members of the president's team were talking about dominating the battle space and, you know, playing with the idea of using the most blunt instruments of American power to try and manage a situation of civil unrest.
Specifically, the George Floyd incident was the alarm bell. I mean, did you see parallels with other events in other countries that preceded elections that gave you that concern?
I would say that the George Floyd killing was the entry point for our looking at U.S. domestic affairs. With regard to the election, yeah, there were four factors in particular that we saw as sort of cross-cutting with other countries. And the ones that we identified in particular were political polarization overlaid with issues of race and identity, the proliferation of armed groups at the fringes of the political spectrum. The third was the prospect of a protracted period when the outcome for the election might be contested, in doubt, where tensions could build between the two sides. And then the fourth was what, you know, we alluded to before, the Trump factor, the fact that this president, and we saw this in the George Floyd context, is not somebody who, you know, tries to heal divides or calm the waters often. He actually stokes tension in order to try and achieve personal and political goals.
With the exception of a few incidents, American streets have been pretty calm. Does the crisis group see this as a good sign for American democracy?
There's a lot of work that needs to be done to try and heal the polarized nature of American politics. It certainly won't help if the country devolves into a chaotic scene around this election. So from that perspective, yes, to the extent that this can be a relatively calm transition, it's going to allow that healing process to begin from a better place.
Stephen Pomper, Senior Director for Policy at Crisis Group, talking about precautions to be taken as we move through this post-election period. He's been speaking with us from Washington. Stephen, thank you very much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Here's a reminder, the world is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. We report stories from around the globe with nuance, context, and by listening to voices of people most affected by the news. Do your part today to help us keep access to the world free. And right now, when you donate, your contribution will be doubled. The World is participating in Newsmatch, a campaign to raise money for high-quality, independent journalism. To donate, go to theworld.org/give. Or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. waiting on pins and needles for election results here in the U.S. In Europe, they're under lockdowns, impacting people like this guy.
A self-described big, ugly, hairy, right-wing Brexiteer.
This hairy Brexiteer opens up about being vulnerable to social isolation. And the internet crowns the most popular song ever on YouTube. That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. On the U.S.-Mexico border, many people are stuck in limbo south of the Rio Grande, seeking asylum to come to the U.S. The World's Monica Campbell checked in at one migrant shelter in the Mexican city of Juarez, across from El Paso, Texas. Monica reports that for people there, the stakes of the American election could not be bigger.
The last time I saw Pastor Juan Fierro Garcia, the migrant shelter he runs in Juarez was packed. There were Central Americans and Cubans, people from Uganda and Cameroon. Families slept in the pews of the church on site. This week, over WhatsApp, Fierro said the shelter was still full and COVID-19 was a big worry. The ICUs are full in Juarez, just like in El Paso. Thank God. No cases so far, he says. Over his phone, Fierro shows me a new building they've put up.
All
of the COVID rules on the walls there. It's bare bones, but Fierro is proud of it. There's a big room with bunk beds and a dining area. On election night, the TV was turned to the news. About a dozen people were watching, kids with their parents, guys sitting alone.
Yo soy de Cuba. Mi nombre es Pedro Luis Tamayo.
Tamayo from Cuba watched, arms folded, leaning back on a white plastic chair. He fled his home country for political reasons.
Bueno, yo salí de Cuba por razones políticas vía Brasil, ¿entiende? Porque ya no aguantaba más la represión política. Yo era opositor.
He says he was a dissident, an independent journalist, which put him on the wrong side of the government. It was hard to find work, so he sold slices of cake on the street to get by. He worried he'd eventually wind up in prison for his political views, so he left. Tamayo knows the U.S. election system inside out. When I said I was calling from California, he said, 55. Your state gets 55 electoral votes. Tamayo wants to live in Florida, so he was tracking the vote there. He supports Trump's hardline policies against Cuba, but he prefers Joe Biden because of his more welcoming immigration plan.
Si gana Biden, las perspectivas son buenas.
He knows Biden's promise to end, on day one, a key Trump policy known as Remain in Mexico. It's forced Tamayo and tens of thousands of other asylum seekers to wait in Mexico for U.S. court dates. Tamayo's been at the shelter in Juarez for more than a year. That's not unusual. And right now, U.S. officials aren't letting any asylum seekers into the country. They say COVID-19 makes it too risky. Immigration lawyers are trying to help. Taylor Levy lives in El Paso, but regularly heads to the shelter in Juarez.
We're going to Little Caesars, and I'm going to go buy a bazillion pizzas for a Pan de Vida, and we're going to go have a pizza party at Pan de Vida.
I reached her just as she was grabbing food to take back to a shelter for election night.
Like, instead of being home kind of doom-scrolling, basically I decided that the absolute best way I could spend my time would be to come over here and just give legal advice to people and kind of explain what are the different possibilities with the outcome for the elections.
Levy's hoping Biden wins the election and returns to policies that allow asylum seekers to wait out their cases in the U.S., often with relatives already living in America. In Mexico, they're stuck in squalid camps and crowded shelters and often targeted by cartels who may kidnap them and extort their families in the U.S. for money. She's met parents in Juarez who fear the conditions they're in and make desperate choices.
It's just a lot of the parents who I spoke to in the shelters, some of them have, you know, been separated from their children because they've sent their children ahead alone because they feel like it's the only way to keep them safe.
Levy also hopes that Biden would learn from the mistakes she said the Obama administration made on immigration. Some advocates call Obama the deporter-in-chief for expelling immigrants at rates that Trump has yet to surpass.
We hope that not only has Biden and his administration, if they come into power, not only have they learned from their past mistakes, but also that public sentiment has shifted. And we know how horrific and traumatizing some of these policies can be to people.
Juan Fierro Garcia, who runs the migrant shelter in Juarez, is also hoping that Biden becomes president and implements a more humane immigration policy. He also says that could increase the number of people showing up at his shelter.
Harían, de alguna manera, el acercarse a las fronteras de Estados Unidos y México para pedir asilo político.
He believes a change in the White House could lead more migrants to seek refuge in the U.S., and that could be one of the first tests of a Biden presidency. For The World, Monica Campbell.
If it seems like you're constantly refreshing your browser to get the latest news, we understand. But slow down and zoom out for a global picture of the U.S. election. Subscribe to our newsletter, Top of the World, news from around the globe in one email. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Last night, England went back into lockdown at 1 minute past midnight. Pubs, restaurants, and non-essential shops and places of worship are all closed today, and they will stay shut until the 2nd of December. That's a trend in other parts of Europe as well. Belgium, France, Ireland, the Czech Republic have all imposed national lockdowns. And on Saturday, so does Greece, one of the EU countries with the lowest coronavirus infection rates. Our Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, joins us from London. So day one of lockdown in England, Orla, does it feel just like the last time around?
Actually, strangely enough, Marco, it feels very different this time around, which I didn't expect. First of all, last night was essentially a little like New Year's Eve in parts of London. People were out drinking until everything shut. Everything closed at 10 o'clock and the police arrived. And last time around, I remember in the days coming up to lockdown, London was virtually deserted. There was a real sense of fear, I guess, of the virus and what was happening. And people were very compliant with the government restrictions. I think things might be a little bit different this time around. I passed one coffee shop earlier and there was a large queue outside the door of people queuing for takeaway. It's a place called Comptoir Gourmand near London Bridge. I talked to its director, Quentin Wind, about how business had been today.
It's been pretty good. We're a business that is serving takeaway. We didn't need to close. We do feel very sorry, obviously, with all the restaurants and bars, especially all the effort they've put into to make sure that everyone's kind of safe. And unfortunately, a lot of them had to close down until further notice. But as we stand right now for the first day, it's been quite busy for us. So we're quite happy to be able to keep our staff, don't need to furlough them, and then we'll see how it goes.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson had said not so long ago he would not impose another national lockdown again. So how has this U-turn gone down within his party and opposition parties in Britain?
Yes, interestingly enough, Marco, most of the dissent from politicians about the lockdown has actually come from Boris Johnson's own Tory colleagues. But here's the Prime Minister in Parliament explaining the reason for his change of heart.
None of us came into politics to tell people once again to shutter their shops, to furlough their staff, or stay away from their friends and family. And I'm common with all members, feel the pain and anxiety that we're all going to share in the month ahead. But as Prime Minister, when I'm confronted with data that projects our NHS could even collapse, with deaths in the second wave potentially exceeding those of the first, I can reach only one conclusion. I'm not prepared to take the risk with the lives of the British people.
So it went to a vote, and most of those who voted against it were from the Conservative Party. And this was one of them. He's Conservative MP Steve Baker. He was speaking on national television after the vote.
In 28 days' time, I'm very clear what my view will be. We've got to learn to live with it. And if in 28 days the Prime Minister hasn't demonstrated a plan to deliver to live with it, I will certainly organise against. And then I'm afraid it will be a very unhappy Christmas.
As I said, England is not the only country in Europe headed into lockdown this week. Greece is facing a national lockdown tomorrow. How does Greece compare with other European countries at this moment?
Yeah, Greece had been doing very well. It did much better and it is doing much better still than most of its EU neighbours. But in the last few weeks, the numbers have really started to rise. So today they recorded almost 3,000 new cases. And the authorities there have said the infection rate has jumped 20% in the last few days. So this has led the Prime Minister to make that announcement, a 3-week national lockdown starting from Saturday. In terms of how countries are faring in Europe, Belgium, for example, again this time around, it has the rather unenviable title at the moment of being the worst affected country in the EU per capita. And it's gone back into lockdown and will stay in lockdown until December. In France, this evening, they're talking about the national lockdown, which is in place, actually not working because their figures are continuing to go up. And they're talking about additional measures to be put into place in Paris. It already has the strictest lockdown in Europe as it is. Then there's countries like the Czech Republic doing badly. Ireland is also in a national lockdown. And then a lot of the EU, the countries have a sort of a partial or softer lockdown going on at the moment. Germany, for example, just have their bars and restaurants being closed. In Spain, they have a nationwide curfew. And then Italy is taking that regional tier approach where 4 regions in Italy are to go into a partial lockdown at the end of the week. And I think probably the only country in Europe that we won't see going into lockdown is going to be Sweden.
Wow. You cannot let your guard down. The world's Orla Barry in London on day one of national lockdown, number 2 in England. Thank you, Orla, and good luck.
You're welcome, Marco.
As the number of coronavirus cases in Europe climbs, many countries are imposing new restrictions to try and curb the spread of the virus. We know that social distancing is critical, but it does come with a cost, social isolation. James Price recently wrote an essay in the British newspaper The Telegraph about what restrictions could do to people's mental health. He also wrote about his own past struggles. Price is a former special advisor to the UK Conservative Party and joins me now. And just a warning, we will talk about suicide in this interview. Please take care while listening. James Price, welcome. What prompted you to bring attention to what lockdowns can do to people struggling with mental health?
I found myself walking through a very deserted and quiet London just after 10 o'clock as we put in a 10 o'clock curfew across the whole of the UK. So every pub and every restaurant has to sort of kick everybody out at 10 o'clock. And I found myself wandering through London and looking up at all the little units of housing where people younger than me just moved to London for a new job or something like that, live in quite small and enclosed situations and circumstances and spend perhaps most of their time now working from home. And I realised that this will have a very negative impact on the mental health of a lot of people. I've got some sad experience with this myself, of these kinds of struggles. And as I write in the essay, a self-described big, ugly, hairy, right-wing Brexiteer, to describe myself, if I can know that you can go through these sorts of struggles and know that it's important to talk about it, I felt that it was important to do that, knowing what we're going to be facing this winter with other people facing the same fate.
Are you seeing evidence of widespread mental health issues already?
I think the problem is that, like the coronavirus itself, it's something of a silent killer. And lots of people feel they can't talk about it. The Princes William and Harry have been quite good at talking about these sorts of things. And I think that celebrities in general are starting to talk about it. But I think still it's only a very small section of society who feels capable of talking about it. The reason I say as a big, ugly right winger or whatever I describe myself as, I think lots and lots of people, and particularly people who will never have had these sorts of mental health problems before, will be finding themselves in this sort of situation and feel they're incapable of talking about it and getting any of the help they may need. And quite literally suffering in silence.
I mean, you were very open about your own struggles with mental health and even past attempts to take your life. You even talk about the British propensity to keep a stiff upper lip and the old keep calm and carry on kind of attitude. What took you to this level of honesty? Had you been this open before?
I had in little bits and bobs to friends and things like that, but I thought it was, again, important to show again that if I can do it, then maybe other people can as well. And as you say, it's not a terribly fun set of stories, talking about being sort of so depressed that you were about to jump off a bridge and calling up my mum and sort of saying goodbye and apologising until she quite literally talked me down off the edge. And it's hopefully, as you can hear from the tone of my voice, I'm an awful lot better now and have gone on to hopefully do some good in the world. But I think trying to share these sorts of stories, as painful as perhaps they are, and showing that you can come out the other side. And I think it's important to share these sorts of hopeful stories at a time when everything can feel so, frankly, so bleak. But I think, frankly, talking about one's struggles and showing that you can overcome them should hopefully be seen to be both a sign of strength and certainly a non-partisan issue, or at least a bipartisan issue. I really do think that in the same way that having a broken leg is not a left wing or a right wing issue, why is it he's having some kind of mental health struggle?
Globally, experts are expecting this next wave of COVID-19 cases to get worse as we head into the winter. So what reasonably should UK leaders do to lessen the potential spread, but also make sure mental health is being considered through all this?
Yeah, it's a very tough issue. And I think that the sort of lockdown argument is raging across everywhere. I'm sort of skeptical of how effective they are, but I'm aware of the need to do something about it so that our healthcare systems are not entirely overwhelmed. What the piece really argues for is to try and take a greater level of thought into the side effects and the negative externalities of the lockdowns and to try and provide for it. I know when I was very poorly, suffering sort of depression and things I've talked about, I was not able to get help very quickly. So the waiting list in the UK with the National Health Service are incredibly long and far too long for when people actually need the help. So I do think that there's some kind of extra provision or at least a promise that there'll be funding for these sorts of things in the future and a bigger awareness campaign of the side effects of lockdowns is really, really important.
James Price is a former special advisor to the Conservative Party in the UK. We'll link to his article about mental health. Find it on our website, theworld.org. James, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And just a note, if you or someone you know is having suicidal thoughts, reach out for help. Here in the U.S., the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is open 24 hours a day at 800-273-8255. We featured the musician Helado Negro on the show before. He's back with a new single, a cover of a song that Neil Young wrote some time ago.
It's gonna take a lot of love to change the way things are.
Helado Negro says it was the U.S. election and multiple crises around the world that made him consider recording Lot of Love. He's been holed up in the artist community of Marfa, Texas, during quarantine, working on a symphony. But he'd been listening to Lot of Love and appreciated the song's theme of protection and the sense of calm it gave him, and thought it would do the same for others. So, with a little time before the break, we share it with you.
So if you look in my direction and we don't see eye to eye,
musician Helado Negro there covering Neil Young's Lot of Love with help from Flock of Dimes and Devendra Banhart on vocals. Speaking of help, I hope that did. Flooding, droughts, and extreme temperatures have skyrocketed in the past two decades. They've become more deadly and expensive. The shift has been largely due to climate change, according to a recent report from the UN. Only a global effort to curb greenhouse gases can reverse this trend. But there is more we can do to prepare for more extreme events. That's the focus of our weekly look at climate change solutions, The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
I spoke earlier with Mami Mizutori, the UN's head of disaster risk reduction. She says a key to dealing with risk is employing what's called disaster risk governance.
I might use the crisis we are facing of COVID-19
There have been governments which have coped better. For example, the Republic of Korea. In the past, they had experienced an epidemic, SARS-MERS. They had a plan. They had a plan about what shall we do when the next epidemic or even a pandemic comes. They invested into their public health system. They put together a test and trace system. Good risk governance is, do you have political leadership that looks into all the risks your country is facing? Do you have a vision? Do you have competent institutions? And do you put a budget against all this to save lives and reduce economic losses?
So leadership, obviously very important. What else makes a national strategy successful when it comes to being more resilient to climate disasters?
You need to really have a whole of government approach and a whole of society approach. An example that I wanted to give you is one from Bangladesh. So in 1970, when a huge cyclone hit the country, 1 million people died. They put in a cyclone preparedness program about having a better forecasting system, having better shelters, but importantly also educating the people so that people know that when there is an early warning about a cyclone, they need to evacuate. Last year, when there was a similar level of cyclone that hit the country, 2 million people evacuated swiftly, and the casualty was 19 people. Compare this with 1 million. I think we know what it means to have a good risk governance in place.
Some people, when they think of disasters, they think of a destructive hurricane or a flood or a fire engulfing a community. But if COVID-19 has taught us anything, it's that disasters are connected to each other. They can affect each other. How does recognizing the systemic nature of disasters help us actually create plans to be more resilient?
This is what we call systemic risk. One thing leads to another, and the impact is cascading. And this is because it's a very connected world. And when we say connected, it also means that it doesn't stay in your country. A systemic risk needs a systemic approach, a systemic solution. It's not like you can only be prepared for a flood or an earthquake. What you cannot do is to have one ministry, one agency in charge of disaster risk reduction, risk governance, that does not have the necessary connection with all other ministries, all other sectors of the society. You need to bring in the voices and needs of every sector, the private sector, the civil society, and most importantly, the people who are vulnerable.
One thing your report highlights is the inequality of these climate disasters impacts on richer countries versus poorer countries. So what is currently the ability of wealthier nations to assist when disasters strike? And what's it going to mean in the future when countries get torn apart by hurricanes or typhoons, for example?
Of course, it's a humanitarian issue. But now we know that more people are displaced by disasters due to climate emergency, whether it's a hurricane or a storm or a cyclone or a drought, than people who are displaced by conflicts. So supporting these countries to have a better system for preventing risks from becoming disaster is not only about helping these countries, but ultimately stopping this huge potential move of people that always creates other issues. We are just as safe as the weakest link in our global community.
You have said, Mami, that you find it baffling that many nations around the world continue, quote, in your words, to sow the seeds of our own destruction despite the science and evidence that we are turning our only home to an uninhabitable hell for millions of people, end quote. What do you think it will take to reverse course away from this dangerous future that you are imagining?
I feel that what is going to change the course is the voice of people, in particular, the younger people who see this as an existential threat, as a real erosion of their prosperous future. They will start voting for change, implementing policies for change, and we are already seeing it, we are already hearing it. And I believe that this will make a change.
Mami Muzutori is the head of the United Nations Office for Disaster Risk Reduction. She's been speaking with us from Geneva. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much.
We leave you today with a kid song that inspired a global dance movement, even became an anthem for baseball fans of the World Series. If you have kids at home, The tune's probably already driven you crazy, so apologies. I am talking, of course, about this. Baby Shark, the earworm, was put out on YouTube 5 years ago by the South Korean educational company Pinkfong. This week, it became the most watched YouTube video ever. More than 7 billion plays. Looped continuously, that'd be like playing Baby Shark for more than 30,000 years. Yeah, we did the math. The song has been translated into more than 19 languages so far, to Chinese, Dutch, Thai, and Diné, the language of the Navajo people, living primarily in the southwestern United States. More than 7 billion streams has also pocketed the company Pinkfong a cool $5 million just from YouTube plays, and launched a toy market. Yes, you can buy stuffed baby sharks. So who did Baby Shark take down to nab the top spot on YouTube? Despacito. Adios Despacito by Luis Fonse. There's a new sheriff in town, and his name, or its name, Baby Shark. Despacito. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston at GBH. We're always online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Keep calm and stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.